Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Citizens United, the landmark speech, money, and elections decision handed down by the United States Supreme Court 10 years ago yesterday. A 5-4 decision that, according to Justice John Paul Stevens, speaking in dissent, would open up American politics to a pernicious flood of corporate money that would dismay even the founders.
It is doubtful that the framers believed the freedom of speech would extend to corporations who cannot themselves engage in speech. And it is even more doubtful that when they ratified the First Amendment, they thought they were laying down a principle that could be used to insulate corporations from even modest restrictions on electioneering expenditures.
Well, no, said Justice Anthony Kennedy. He spoke for the majority, saying the intention of the First Amendment is to protect speech, whether it's delivered by an individual or paid for via a corporation.
When the government seeks to use its full power, including the criminal law, to command where a person may get his or her information, or what distrusted source he or she may not hear, it uses censorship to control thought. This is unlawful. The First Amendment confirms the freedom to think for ourselves.
Those were the broad philosophical arguments for and against Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. A decade later, as 2020 is expected to be the most expensive election year ever, it's time to examine the practical impact of this landmark case. So this hour in Point, Citizens United turns 10. And you can join us. How do you think American politics has changed after Citizens United in the past 10 years? Have you seen a flood of money in our elections? Do you think it's made a difference in terms of how people vote? Or has it not? Has it actually protected First Amendment rights in America? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we're going to start today with Carrie Levine. She joins us from Washington. She's a senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and she's long been investigating the influence of money in politics. Carrie, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so how much has American politics changed in the 10 years since Citizens United?
You know, the change over the past 10 years on the campaign finance landscape, money and politics, has really been seismic. And it tracks back to Citizens United. I think this is the time period we're looking at. That's not the only reason, but it's a big reason. It really created a chance for people to spend unprecedented amounts of money influencing elections without limit.
Is that what has happened, though? I mean, I think that's one of the key questions, that there was this fear. And in fact, let's play a moment in 2010, just a week after the Supreme Court issued its ruling, where none other than President Barack Obama, giving his State of the Union address, actually said he articulated this fear that a lot of Democrats or liberals had about the approval of the Citizens United case. And here he talked about the potential consequences of the decision.
Last week, the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections. I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interests, or worse, by foreign entities. They should be decided by the American people.
President Barack Obama in 2010. So, Carrie, let's sort of dissect this a little bit. Has corporate spending on American elections post-Citizens United, has it ballooned the way Obama feared it might?
Interestingly, no. Corporations, I think, have been wary of getting too political. There was a really interesting case in 2010, not long after the decision came out, that I think made them warier. In that example, Target gave $150,000 to a group that was running ads in support of a candidate in Minnesota, I believe, who opposed same-sex marriage. And so when news of that corporate contribution broke, Target was subject to a huge backlash. There were protests from gay rights supporters. There was a push to boycott Target. And the company said, well, we actually gave the money because we support this candidate's positions on business issues, not social issues. That's not why we did it. And that just really wasn't enough for people who were upset. The company eventually apologized. They changed their policies about political spending. But I think a lot of public companies who deal with the general population saw that backlash and realized they had to be really prepared for consequences if they waded into this. So corporations have actually not – public corporations, big sort of publicly traded corporations have not been behind the boom in spending. They've actually accounted for a very small percentage of contributions to powerful outside groups. The Center for Responsive Politics looked at this around the 2018 elections and found that only a few dozen public companies had given $25,000 or more to super PACs, to outside groups that can take unlimited contributions from companies since 2012. That's a pretty small fraction of the money that's poured into elections.
Okay, interesting. So I was just about to ask you if we're talking about direct contributions to candidates or we're talking about super PACs. But it sounds like you're saying that American corporations have not been pouring money into either place.
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask. So one thing Citizens United didn't do is allow anyone to give unlimited contributions to candidates.
Right.
So companies, as they have for a long time, continue to give through political action committees that are subject to limits. But no person or company can turn around and write a candidate's campaign a check with a million zeros at the end. There are limits of $2,800 per candidate per election, and those are in force. So when we talk about giving large amounts of money, unlimited amounts of money, what the Supreme Court did was make it legal to spend that, and subsequent court decisions that built on Citizens United made it legal for companies or people to give unlimited contributions to independent outside groups that aren't under the direct control of the candidate. And those are often referred to as super PACs, those types of groups. Nonprofits also can accept those contributions, some types of nonprofits, but candidates can't.
Okay. There's a lot of detail here that I'm going to hope that you can help us understand so we can get a real fair assessment here about the past 10 years. So regarding super PACs, though, are outside individuals able to look at who the donors to a super PAC are?
Yes. One thing that the Supreme Court did in Citizens United was uphold disclosure requirements. The government is allowed to require that political spending be disclosed. Now, super PACs file reports detailing their spending and contributions with the Federal Election Commission. Anyone can go look it up. I spend a lot of time looking at reports like that, and they do have to disclose their donors. That said, there are ways to make it harder to find out where the money comes from. And, it's not perfect. It's pretty easy to hide the original source of money if someone contributes through, for instance, an OPEC limited liability company that's hard to trace back, or to a nonprofit that then turns around and gives money to a super PAC, but the nonprofit doesn't have to reveal the original donor. There's ways to shield the original source of money. So when you look at a super PAC campaign finance filing, in some cases it lists the donor, in some cases it lists a source of money that would then take more work to track back if you even can.
So there are ways to make it go dark, essentially.
There are ways to make it go dark, and that's what's often referred to as dark money.
And are these super PACs, are we confusing terms when we overlap them with those 503C4s? Is that right?
501C4s. So when most Americans give to charity, they give to what's known as a 501c3 nonprofit. You give to a group that is engaged in charitable work, you get a tax deduction for your donation. 501c4s are social welfare groups. That's what that type of nonprofit is called. They're allowed to engage in some political spending. 501c3s, public charities, are not. So 501c4s are allowed to spend money to influence elections, but it can't be their primary purpose. So in practice, though, we've seen those types of nonprofits, as well as trade associations, which are another type of nonprofit, spend millions of dollars on elections.
I see. And they're spending millions of dollars on elections, on candidates, on advertising, independent of the candidate's actual campaigns. They all have very confusing and generic, names that make them sound like they're as wholesome as sliced bread. I mean, it does
actually... Americans for cuter puppies.
Yeah, I mean, it does... Even if the actual dollar amount that corporations have spent since 2010, when Citizens United was decided, hasn't gone up dramatically, there's also still this ballooning of the overall amount of money being spent in American elections. So where is all the money coming from?
That's right. And so it's important to say that, a recent report by the Center for Responsive Politics found that election-related spending from those types of independent groups really ballooned over the past decade. It went from $750 million over the two decades before the decision to $4.5 billion over the decades since Citizens United. And so that's a huge increase. And in some races, you know, you look at some congressional elections or districts, you can see that independent groups actually spend more money than the candidates. And so they're really powerful voices sometimes in the outcome of a race.
Right. Sorry, Carrie. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
And in terms of where all that money is coming from, I think what we've seen is you've heard the term mega donors. Maybe most people have heard the term mega donors. But there's a small number of very wealthy people who have put in millions of dollars into these groups. And so very often you see this money coming from wealthy donors.
I mean, we're talking about a small number of billionaires, essentially, who are donating tens or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's right. And so the report found that the 10 biggest donors and their spouses together put about $1.2 billion into elections over the last decade.
10 donors and their spouses putting $1.2 billion into elections in the past decade in the United States? That's remarkable. So Carrie Levine, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about 10 years after the Citizens United case was decided in the Supreme Court. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It was 10 years ago yesterday that the United States Supreme Court decided the historic Citizens United case that really made some significant changes to campaign finance and corporate free speech in America. And we want to hear from you. How do you think American politics, American elections have changed, if at all, in the 10 years since Citizens United? Was it a good decision? Do you want it overturned? Carrie Levine joins us today. She's senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, and she investigates the influence of money in politics. And let's quickly go to the phones. Danny is calling from Bush, Louisiana. Danny, you're on the air.
I don't think it makes any difference what the law is or what Supreme Court decisions there are. If people have money or have a way to get their message out, they will, and they feel strongly about an issue, they will get their message out. You've got this guy, Michael Bloomberg, who is pledging to spend $2 billion to get rid of President Bush. You've got George Soros spending millions to get rid of attorney generals that he doesn't like. If you have money, whether you have own a newspaper or you are a corporation or you any way you got money, you can influence politics. So
yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Well, Danny, you mentioned Michael Bloomberg, George Soros. On the other side of the ledger, there'd be Sheldon Adelson also spending many millions of dollars as well. I mean, I guess billionaires gonna spend, right? But thank you so much for your call. Let's turn now to Bradley Smith, who's joining us from Columbus, Ohio. He's a law professor at Capital University Law School. In the year 2000, he was nominated by President Clinton to serve in the Federal Election Commission, where he served for 5 years, including as chairman of the FEC in 2004. So Bradley Smith, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Pleasure to be here.
Has the sky fallen in the past 10 years?
No, the sky has not fallen. And I think to understand why, Citizens United is an interesting case. There's some ways both more there and less there than meets the eye. And to understand why the sky hasn't fallen, you have to understand the framework beforehand. For example, a lot of people say Citizens United, you know, held that money equals speech. Well, actually, it didn't hold that. It holds that money facilitates speech, and you can't try to limit speech by limiting money, just like you couldn't get around Roe v. Wade by saying you can't spend any money to pay a doctor or buy equipments or anything to exercise your right to an abortion, right? And furthermore, the decisions in that way didn't begin with Citizens United. They go back far beyond that, at least to a case called Buckley v. Valeo from 1976. So in that respect, you know, it's not that great a change. Likewise, Citizens United doesn't hinge on the concept of corporate personhood. That really wasn't an issue in the case. Nobody argued it. That's been recognized by the Supreme Court for 200 years. So we have to look at, you know, what then was interesting about it. A couple other points that people don't realize is before Citizens United, corporations were allowed to spend freely in candidate races, in state races like governor, state attorney general and so on, in over half our states. So it's not like it was unheard of to have corporations spending money in political elections. Mm. Now, does the case matter? Yeah, it certainly matters because it does establish an important principle, I think, that the government can't use prior restraint to stop people from speaking and stop voters from hearing voices. And we remember the case at hand involved an effort by a group, Citizens United, to promote and distribute a documentary movie about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Was it a biased documentary? Sure, it was a biased documentary. Was it a especially good documentary? Probably not. But I don't think the First Amendment has ever said, well, if you're biased, you lose your First Amendment rights. Or it's ever said, if it doesn't meet our standard as film critics, you lose your First Amendment rights. So the case is very important from a doctrinal standpoint. And it has influenced the way in which money is used in politics in a number of ways, some for better and some for worse. But I think on the whole, for better.
Well, to be honest, I asked you that sky is falling question. It was I was being deliberately churlish here because I mean,
I figured that.
Carrie laid out quite a bit of reportorial detail what has changed in the past 10 years. And so let me ask you, Professor Smith. Okay, perhaps corporate spending hasn't gone up all that much in elections. I mean, they can just do lobbying in Washington, I guess, which is more effective for them. And they're finding it's not great business to be publicly aligned with one candidate or the other. Point taken. But Kerry also said that one of the other practical consequences that we've seen in the past decade is this: a mere 10 people in the United States, a mere 10 families, have spent $1.2 billion on American elections. That, too, is something that has been unleashed by Citizens United. And does that not have a pernicious effect on democracy? If we're talking about speech here, clearly 10 individuals are able to have speech that is much more pervasive, much louder than the other 330 million Americans.
Well, it certainly is a lot of money to be spent, but you know, it's been spent all across the political spectrum for all kinds of views, and it's helped Americans hear lots of different views. And if we remember that we spent in those 10 years, you know, about $30 billion, I mean, it's still a tremendous amount of money, but it doesn't seem quite so large when we put it in that kind of context. So is it particularly bad? Again, this comes from all spectrums. You pointed out to the last caller, to Danny, from Louisiana. You know, you got people on the left, you got people on the right. Lots of different views being heard, and on the whole, that's a good thing. And you know, in terms of the other thing that should be noticed, of course, that was all legal spending before Citizens United. Now, this is where Citizens United is kind of interesting. Legally, all those individuals could have spent that money beforehand. What Citizens United did, I think, was just make people aware of the possibilities of what they could do. For those with long memories and the older listeners might think back to something like the old Patco strike that Ronald Reagan broke back in 1981, the air traffic controller strike. And that strike, it was important for what he did there too. But from a labor standpoint, a lot of corporations said, oh, we can do this. And they started doing breaking strikes in a way that they had not before. So in that respect too, Citizens United might have encouraged more of these wealthy individuals to get involved. But remember again, the criticism of Citizens United is it's going to allow corporate spending. And that's what the case was about, corporate and union spending. And it didn't. We estimate if you attribute, you know, all dark money, I mean, you talk about dark money, all dark money is about 3-4% of total political spending in the country. And some of that existed before Citizens United. It's not a new phenomenon. If we count all of that as corporate spending, and we know that it wasn't all corporate, but we don't know exactly where it's from. So if we count it all as corporate, you get corporate spending of maybe 5-6% tops in federal elections. So nobody's being drowned out. And those are important voices for people to hear. People should be able to hear those voices, hear what the business community thinks. More of the corporations that benefit most tend to be small corporations. This has been pointed out. Public corporations don't want to be out there on this kind of thing. Moreover, they can afford to operate large political action committees that long predate Citizens United. Small businesses can't afford the cost of operating political action committees. So for them, participating directly through trade associations and so on has been much more of a boon than it has been for the corporate for the Fortune 500 corporations.
Carrie Levine, do you have a thought about what Bradley Smith's saying?
I think it's a really interesting point. I think what Brad is really asking, if I hear him right, is this bad? And people disagree on that. And that's partly what someone like me spends her time covering. And Brad and I have certainly talked about it before. People disagree about whether it's bad or not. I do think that he's making one very important point, which was that some of the consequences of the Citizens United decision that have changed things over the last 10 years, it goes beyond what was explicitly allowed in that decision. There have been other decisions that continued the deregulatory push. There has been backlash to the Citizens United decision that's been powerful, that is, I think, in part fueled the rise of the small donor boom and the debate that we see now going on in the Democratic presidential primary about how candidates should raise money, how much access they should give to donors, whether they should welcome outside support from groups like super PACs. And so I think the consequences of it go beyond what is explicitly allowed by the decision itself and into everything that has kind of happened since.
Right. And that's what we're trying to examine, what has actually happened, practically happened in the past 10 years since the ruling was made. Let's go to John, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I definitely feel that based off of everything that I've heard, I personally felt that Citizens United has been probably one of the worst decisions that our country has gone through. It completely, I feel, undermines our democracy. It basically says those who have money can put as much money that they can afford and allocate to the narrative, the messaging that they want to put out there, and those who don't essentially don't have that ability. On top of that, with corporations, yeah, everyone makes a fair point about how the public companies don't really want to get into it. But it's usually, you know, corporations can own other corporations, they can have subsidiaries, and by the time all the purchasing takes place and the money is spent, you know, it's going to take a forensic accountant to kind of figure out exactly where the money goes and comes from. And, you know, I'd like to hear how some of your guests feel about, like, you know, with elections in the past where you can have money coming from foreign agents under the disguise of a corporation. So that sounds very American, very cookie cutter-ish, and it ends up influencing and impacting how people vote because they don't know what's true, what's fact. And, you know, that's, again, that's the First Amendment right there, too. You can go ahead and, you know, just say what they want to say because that's what things like Facebook is designed
right.
for.
Right. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Bradley Smith, you want to respond?
Well, sure. I mean, it raises a point that's carried us as well that, you know, I mean, there's good and bad and everything, and this is what people need to think about. You know, the alternative to John says, you know, it undermines democracy is to think about, do we want the federal government deciding who's spoken too much, who's spoken too little, what kind of speakers we don't want to hear from? We don't want to hear from corporate speakers, but we want to hear from other kinds of speakers. And I think the First Amendment is designed, you know, specifically to prevent that. In terms of like foreign money, foreign contributions are still illegal. Moreover, it's a foreign company can't just create a U.S. subsidiary and start dumping money into it and spending that on politics. That is also still illegal. And so there's always ways that people can violate the law, and people could have violated the law before. You know, if you talk about the Facebook spending, which was mentioned, most of that is outside of the campaign finance arena because it wasn't specifically urging people to vote for or against candidates. Much of it had nothing to do with paid advertising but rather, you know, false accounts. And even when we put all that together, it's a very small percentage of the total. So you've got to weigh that, you know, against the risk of having government censorship here. And I often point out that, you know, even during the Cold War, at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s, you know, we did not, although there were efforts, but we did not start surrendering our First Amendment rights, you know, because we were concerned that we just couldn't handle the possibility of some Russian influence. And the fact that we would let that happen now to the rump state of the Soviet Union seems to me kind of a lack of will on our part and a lack of, you know, optimism that American yeah. voters are intelligent and they can hear the news and they can hear different views and they deserve to hear different views.
So we're going to hear a different view in just a second here. But Bradley Smith, my last question for you is one that I think a lot of listeners keep coming back to, and that when we're talking about First Amendment rights here regarding a corporation. I mean, Justice Stevens, we played at the very beginning of the hour when he delivered his dissent, he said that he thought he was completely doubtful that the founders, when they ratified the First Amendment, thought they were laying down a principle used to insulate corporations from modest restrictions on electioneering expenditures. I mean, a corporation is actually a creation of government and business. It is not an individual. I get it. The court has ruled on this, but that is the fundamental sort of philosophical divide here, is it not?
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, there's two things. First, I also don't think the founders thought that the Constitution or the First Amendment would allow the government to do prior restraint of a documentary about a candidate. Now, when we think about, you know, the question of corporations, right? Corporations have rights because the people who own them have rights. And we think about like nonprofits that are spending, like the Sierra Club and the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Realtors and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund and so on. These are all incorporated entities, right? But they are incorporated by people who incorporate them specifically for the purpose of engaging in public affairs and other types of activities they want to engage in. So just like, you know, you can't the government can't pop into a corporation. They can't go raid Ben and Jerry's without a search warrant or a reasonable cause just because it's a corporation and doesn't have any rights, right? They can't take away the rights that people have because people are the ones who are affected. So the question is, how far do rights go? Should we allow limits on individuals? Should we allow individuals or limits on individuals acting as a group, i.e. as a corporation? And those are tough questions. There are mm-hmm. troubling questions about money in politics. But in the end, again, you know, I tend to come down on the side that we don't really want to put government in charge of this. That's what the whole First Amendment was about. And if we look at the predictions that were made at the time of Citizens United, remember, they were catastrophic. This was going to be the worst thing since Dred Scott and so on. And I think we can just see that those have not come true.
Well, Bradley Smith, law professor at Capital University Law School, who also formerly served on the FEC as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Magna. And if I can say so, by the way, I'm also head of the Institute for Free Speech, and people can find more on that by looking at the Institute for Free Speech website. Thank you.
Point duly taken. Thanks again. So let's turn now to get that differing view here. Let's go to Rick Hassan. He joins us from Los Angeles. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of the forthcoming book, Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Professor Hassan, welcome to you.
Great to be with you.
So you heard Bradley Smith saying that if you look broadly across all of election spending in the United States in the past 10 years, there's nothing to be worried about in terms of the impact of Citizens United. Your thought?
Well, I disagree. I think I agree with Brad that the amount of for-profit corporate spending that's reported is relatively low. But I think that's what we expected. We know that for-profit corporations don't want to alienate their customers. And so when they're going to spend, they're going to spend it in an undisclosed way. But I think that what Citizens United did was unleash a series of additional court cases and FEC rulings, which have fundamentally transformed our politics. The rise of super PACs, the fact that in the 2010 election, the largest contributors to election campaigns gave about $7.5 million. Now in 2018, a midterm election, we saw Sheldon and Miriam Adelson give $122 million. Mm. And that's just in disclosed money. So that's changed. Super PACs have created a conduit for foreign money to come into elections through limited liability corporations. We saw this that Lev Parnas supposedly gave $300,000 of Ukrainian oligarch money to a pro-Trump super PAC. None of this would have been possible before Citizens United. So foreign money is coming into our elections. And also it's had a psychological effect. Even though before Citizens United, individuals could spend very large sums on elections, now they're spending much less.
Yeah.
They're spending much more, I should say, than they used to be able to do.
So Rick Hassan and Carrie Levine, stand by here for a moment. Just a super quick break. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. We're taking a look at the practical impact that the Citizens United decision has had in the 10 years since the Supreme Court decided it. It was 10 years ago yesterday. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Citizens United and a 10th anniversary of the historic Supreme Court case that really changed campaign finance and elections in this country. I'm joined today by Carrie Levine. She's senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, and she investigates the influence of money in politics. And Rick Hassan also joins us. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. Carrie, let me just turn to you quickly here, because before the break, if I heard Professor Hassan correctly, he said that post-Citizens United, that there is ways, there are ways of foreign money for foreign money to enter into U.S. elections. Can you clarify that?
Sure. So I think one of the problems with dark money or so-called dark money is that when you don't know the source of the money, it's very hard to tell if it's foreign. And so that's also a problem with corporate structures, which can sometimes make it harder to find out where the money originally came from. And Professor Hassan gave one example. I'm going to give another. Last year, the Federal Election Commission actually fined a super PAC called Right to Rise, which was created during the 2016 presidential primaries to support Jeb Bush, who was a Republican candidate for president. It fined them $390,000, which is a huge fine. And that was because it solicited a contribution from a foreign national. Now, the contribution to the super PAC ultimately came from a company that was, you know, a corporation. But the people involved in approving it and allocating the money, the people who were solicited for the money, were foreign businessmen. And that's not legal. So I think that's an example where here it is. It was 4 years later. And the FEC acted, fined the super PAC, which obviously Jeb Bush was no longer a candidate. Mm-hmm. He wasn't president. It was long after the fact. But that was an example of a group like this serving as a pathway for foreign money, and it was hard to figure out. So I think that what he's saying is the more opaque that you make this, the more pathways you create,
right,
the more of a chance foreign money has to find its way into elections. Now, as Brad pointed out, it's illegal. It's still illegal. Citizens mm-hmm. United didn't change that, but it does make it harder to see.
Right. Okay, so Professor Hassan, you've got a forthcoming book called Election Meltdown, but also in 2016, you wrote a book called Plutocrats United, Campaign Money, the Supreme Court, and the Distortion of American Elections. And I want to ask you to reflect on something that we heard Bradley Smith saying. You know, he wasn't troubled by the fact that we have this small group of American billionaires who are spending vast amounts of money in elections, right? Kerry was saying that 10 families essentially spending $1.2 billion. We've got Sheldon Adelson spending more than $120 million just in the 2018 midterms alone. Michael Bloomberg's going to be spending a lot of money this year, and so is Tom Steyer as well. We've almost become used to it. But it seemed to me that Bradley Smith was saying, that's not all. They're not drowning out other voices because the many millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people who might be giving Bernie Sanders $27 a piece are also being able to have their say. So one isn't outweighing the other. Do you buy that?
Well, I think what we want to do is distinguish between money that goes for the purpose of electing candidates and money that goes for the purpose of influencing politics once someone is elected to office. And so while I do think it's true that money doesn't buy election outcomes, if it did, Jeb Bush would have been the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016. He had $200 million or something from a super PAC that was supporting him. But the real issue is that what money does is it buys you access, at the very least, to elected officials, and it lets you shape public policy. And there's a lot of empirical work in political science, I'm thinking particularly the work of Gillens and Page, that shows that American public policy tends to reflect the views of the super wealthy more than the views of the average person. The average person has very little influence over what the government does, while the very wealthy, they get those meetings. They get to make their case. They get to buy the access. Now, I don't necessarily call that corruption, but I call that a problem of profound inequality. And what Citizens United has done, and a series of cases and developments after Citizens United have done, is create the pathway for the wealthy to have even more influence over what public policy looks like once someone is elected. And to me, that's the real problem, and that's the problem I describe in that Plutocrats United book.
Well, so here we are in 2020, and as Kerry was saying earlier, we might be seeing something of a backlash against Citizens United because the number of small donors or small donations is going up to some of these campaigns. But we're also facing the most expensive election cycle in the history of the country. So is this going to go on, like the influence of money in politics, or at the very least sort of the outsized impact that a small number of people might have?
I do think things are going to get worse before they get better. In the 2016 book, Plutocrats United, I said there's one opportunity that's coming to try and change this, and that was when the Supreme Court changes. Maybe there could be a new, less conservative majority that would be willing to accept reasonable limits on money in politics. After all, even someone like Brad Smith doesn't really disagree with the idea that we want to keep foreign money out of elections. And if you think, you know, why do we want to do that? Well, we might want to keep large corporate money or super billionaire money out of elections for the same reasons, because we don't want our politics distorted. The Supreme Court could have said that, but now, of course, we have a Supreme Court that's very conservative. That was the best path to try to get change. And I don't see, for the short term at least, any way out of this. I think the wealthy are going to have even greater influence as we go forward in our next few election cycles.
Well, Rick Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of the forthcoming Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Now, Kerry, I want to turn to Montana here for a second, because we kind of barely mentioned the impact that Citizens United had on the state level. Lots of focus on the federal level. But as we heard earlier, about half of U.S. states had specific laws that Citizens United may have had an impact on. So let's turn to Helena, Montana, where John Adams joins us. He's editor-in-chief of the Montana Free Press. He's covered Montana politics and government for more than a decade. And he was the focus of a 2018 PBS documentary called Dark Money. John Adams, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So what did Citizens United change in Montana?
Well, I think your guest covered a lot of what has changed on the federal level, and certainly we've seen that play out here in Montana as well in terms of seeing huge increases in outside spending by 501c4 groups and those sorts of organizations in our federal elections. But at the state level, we've seen impacts as well, which is a large increase in the prevalence of, again, these 501c4 social welfare organizations that, as your last guest talked about, played a major role in impacting policy outcomes. And in 2012, the 2012 election, you had a group in Montana called the Montana Growth Network that was actually run by a sitting state senator, a Republican senator from Red Lodge named Jason Priest. And that group raised close to $1 million, ostensibly to get a Supreme Court justice elected. So what was Montana Growth Network really about? Well, it turns out that after a lawsuit filed by the state's top political enforcer, the Commissioner of Political Practices, documents revealed in that lawsuit that the primary source of funding for this group, Montana Growth Network, was out-of-state wealthy billionaires who had opposed Montana's public stream access law that's enshrined in the state's constitution. And so there's a group in Montana of the sort of anti-public lands, you know, pro-privatization that has been trying to move towards limiting public access to water, public access to public lands, and it was revealed that that those individuals had actually funded this group. Now, would that have happened without Citizens United? Hard to say, but I think the proliferation of those types of activities certainly increased after Citizens United.
I was just going to ask you. I mean, would Montana state law have allowed such a thing to happen beforehand? And it sounds like maybe not. But since Citizens United, has there been sort of a pushback in Montana?
Yeah, initially, Montana had a 100-year-old law called the Corrupt Practices Act, which prevented corporate spending in elections. And when Citizens United passed, that law was challenged. And Montana fought that all the way up to the Supreme Court and lost, which basically enshrined Citizens United, and it tossed out our state elections law. But in 2013 and again in 2015, there was pushback by a group of, let's say, moderate Republicans in the legislature who teamed up with the Democratic governor to pass a series of reforms to increase transparency. Because the thing about Citizens United is the spending, you can spend all the money you want, and I agree with the previous guest who said that the government shouldn't be censoring speech. Mm-hmm. However, the antidote to that is transparency. And the problem that we have now is we have these 501c4 groups who don't have to disclose their donors, who can essentially lie about their true nature, what it is their actual agenda is. And there's no enforcement because they don't have transparency. And we also have a diminished media who is incapable or don't have the resources to track these things down until years later.
Yeah. Well, John Adams, editor-in-chief of the Montana Free Press, joining us from Helena, Montana. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Carrie Levine, this is really interesting because John there saying that the antidote to perhaps some of the downsides of Citizens United is more transparency, talking about efforts there in Montana. Are we seeing some other efforts along those lines in other states or maybe even at the federal level?
It's so interesting that you bring that up because I think the Supreme Court in its ruling really, you know, was anticipating disclosure as the best disinfectant. And so I think we are seeing some efforts towards disclosure. And immediately after the ruling, Democrats in Congress tried to pass something called the Disclose Act that would have addressed some of these concerns. It didn't pass. And now the Democrats are trying to address some money and politics issues in this big legislation dealing with ethics and money and politics and a bunch of other things called HR1, which the House, you know, has passed. The Democrats have not got, you know, been able to get it through the Republican-controlled Senate. That's something that they're planning to make, I think, an election issue in 2020. And they'd like to see that legislation pass. That would address some of this. Mm-hmm. But I do think that disclosure is something that is a real live issue that could address some of this, make the money easier to follow. And I also think the other issue hanging out there is how independent these outside groups really are.
Right.
The Supreme Court ruled that contributions to independent groups that were acting independently of the candidate, outside the candidate's control, really couldn't be corrupting. But I think some of these groups in practice have very close ties to candidates. We've seen groups run by former aides. We've seen groups run, in some cases, by family members. And we've seen candidates raise money for these groups by appearing at their events, even though they legally have to stop short of requesting contributions that are more than the legally allowed contribution limits that can be given to their campaign. They can just leave the room and have someone else make mm-hmm. the ask. So the wall is thin. In fact, President Trump's campaign has actually put out a statement saying, we only have one approved outside non-campaign group, this super PAC, America First Action, which is run by allies of the president and which we trust. And so how can it be independent but also be an approved outside group?
Mm-hmm.
And so these are unexplored questions in some ways, how far that goes.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to see if I can sneak in one or two last callers. So let's go to Don, who's calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. Don, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm ironically in Frankfort to protest bad government in Kentucky. Was bought a number of years ago when big money came in here and took over our House, and it already owned our Senate. And it took over our governor's race. And then, of course, we had to have a race of and won a race. But still, the rest of the state is owned by Republicans due to big money. I appreciate the show because you talked about subjects I hadn't thought about. But money has been the loudspeaker that gives them the right to be heard over other voices that are there. And our founding fathers, which you all mentioned, they were sexist and racist, and they didn't want everybody to vote anyway. So what about democracy? I'm more interested in democracy, and I don't know that Citizens United addresses this individual spending lots of money. Why not voter guides or public financing of voter guides and public forums and web pages for the candidates and even forums on NPR by candidates? Because we need to hear. And we need as voters, and we need to increase the voters, but they're wanting to suppress voters, the powers that be and the people that have the big money.
Yeah. Well, Don, thank you so much for that call. Carrie, I mean, go ahead. You can go ahead and respond to Don. And I've also got one last question for you about just getting back to this thought of, you said there might be some pushback coming from the levels of individual voters themselves and the increase in small donations. I mean, could that... I don't think it's going to turn the tide of the amount of money in American politics right now, but could it sort of change the politics around Citizens United?
Right. Well, Don, that's a really interesting point. I think that there's a lot of guides and things out there. Part of the issue post-Citizens United with the explosion of these outside groups is always looking at the source of who's giving you the information. And so that's something that the press has taken on that we continue to do. And I think it's going to be important because when candidates aren't speaking directly to you in forums and things like that, it's always a question about where you're getting your information from, who's sponsoring that ad. And so there's a lot of onus on voters to do that work of figuring that out, who to trust and who's giving them reliable information right now in this world where information is coming at them from a lot of sources very quickly. And as to the question of the rise in small dollar donors, the kind of backlash to Citizens United and whether or not this is an issue for voters, I think that the debate in the Democratic presidential primary has been really interesting on this issue. You've seen candidates really publicly say a lot about their stance on money and politics and where they're going to get their money. And I think we're going to see if voters hold them to that.
Well, Carrie Levine, senior reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, she investigates the influence of money in politics, with us today from Washington. Carrie, thank you so much for being with us. This was really, really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me and for doing a show on this topic.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.